This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Let's listen to John Bonham on the drums with Led Zeppelin. Long before Bonham was able to sit behind that drum kit and take it to the next level, that set of skins had a long musical history. Today, it is recognized as a musical instrument in of itself that drives multiple music genres, but it took a long time to get there. Matt Brennan writes about that in his book, Kick It, A Social History of the Drum Kit.
The moment when the drum kit first begins to coalesce is when someone takes a bass drum, which, you know, the previous context for that would have been in a military marching band, and you'll still find them there today. And they decide to take that bass drum, which would ordinarily be strapped to someone's chest, and put it on the floor. And then instead of playing that with their hands, fashioning some sort of technology, a bass drum pedal, to be able to play that with their foot. And then that frees up their hands to play all kinds of other things. So you'd quickly add a couple of other percussion items that you'd see in a marching band context, a snare drum, or sometimes called the side drum, actually. And then, of course, cymbals. Those are sort of the core components. In a modern-day drum kit, you'd have maybe a rack tom, maybe a floor tom, and I suppose the way those cymbals would be spread out would be with, a sort of large ride cymbal on the right-hand side, a crash cymbal, and a pair of hi-hats, which you would play, with a pair of sticks in your hands, but also allow you to open and close those two cymbals together with your foot.
The drum kit was constructed as a way that a musician could perform intricate beats and create sounds, interesting sounds, in a way that using multiple drums, multiple items simultaneously.
Yeah, that's exactly right. At the end of the 19th century, people were trying to recreate all kinds of musical landscapes and styles within the confines of a theater show. So the drummer would be located in an orchestra pit. And if, for instance, there was a military scene that was taking place on stage and they wanted to accompany that, rather than have three drummers try and conjure that atmosphere by playing one instrument each, it became an elegant solution to problems of space and also labor to have one drummer try and play all those things at once through ingenuity of new types of performance practice, but also these new devices and pieces of hardware that allowed them to assemble these disparate percussion instruments together. And then on top of that, you would also find drummers being responsible for sound effects quite often. So the early trap drummers' outfits or early drum kits were also littered with all kinds of literally bells and whistles and other types of effects that would accompany the action on stage, or in the case of silent films, they would accompany the action that was happening in a moving picture on screen.
Here's an example of that, but this is not a drum kit. This is a musical instrument used in silent movie theaters called a photo player. A percussionist sat at this monstrosity, pulling chains called cowtails to produce the sounds of bells, guns, and other oddities.
And then actually that also translates to early ragtime and jazz music, where on these early drum kits, you would have the drummer making all kinds of sounds with klaxons, motor horns, and other assorted noisemakers as part of this new dance music that was emerging in the United States at the time.
So we hear the phrase occasionally, people talking about playing the drums is sitting behind the traps.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the word traps, a lot of people have theorized that the etymology of that word would come from the word contraption, where you have, this new instrument that's being assembled from, odds and ends. But there's another theory, actually, for the origin of the word traps, and that comes from the Victorian term trappings. And I think that that's actually more likely. If you go to the account books of the John Philip Sousa Band, for instance, in the late 19th century, they have items listed there as trappings, which would often get shortened to traps, so the accessories that a person would carry or their personal effects. And the drummer had loads of traps. So, this idea of playing behind a trap set or a trap kit that we still use today, comes from one of those two sources.
So along with the evolution of the drum kit comes the evolution of the drummer, who originally was a person who was seen as really as a non-musician, as someone who just basically played gizmos when they were pointed at. And now we see the drummer as this instrumental person in the band.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And not just any instrumental person, but actually a really core member of that band. And that really occurs with sort of late ragtime and early jazz music and the arrival of a new kind of dance band. People, when we think of bands nowadays, it would be hard to imagine they're not being a drummer because they're really providing the pulse and the beat. That wasn't always the case. This is really an early 20th century development where suddenly having a bass drum playing kind of four on the floor, keeping a pulse for dancers, becomes a convention that is extremely popular and then deemed quite essential.
But that didn't really come about until after electrification, because if you had a drummer who was trying to provide the pulse of the music, then that could overpower the musicians. So the drummer would put the emphasis on the beat in other places, and the heavy downbeat became what the tuba was playing or someone else.
Yeah, that's right. And there's actually, a bit of an historical problem, I guess, because the recordings that we have from, say, the 1920s, the jazz age, there was a real concern that the sound of the drum kit, and particularly the sound of the bass drum and the vibrations coming from it in particular, would disrupt the acoustic recording needle that was used to make recordings at that time. And so drummers don't always get represented on those early jazz recordings as they might have played in a live scenario, because engineers were often quite spooked by drummers. So they were very inconsistent in terms of how they were recorded, but they were often marginalized. And that was certainly the case for one drummer named Baby Dodds, who played with King Oliver and also Louis Armstrong throughout the 1920s. He was an absolutely core element of those bands, but he was often kind of cast to the side in the recording studio, so we don't actually have a good document of what it was that he would have been playing at that time.
We're going to go to a break, but I want to play some of Baby Dodds. And this kind of is when we started seeing drummers become recognized and emerging into their own. Let's go to the break with that. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're exploring the history of the drum kit with Matt Brennan. He's the author of Kick It. This is drummer Baby Dodds playing with his brother Johnny on clarinet and Louis Armstrong. The tune is New Orleans Stomp.
Dodds would have been playing a drum kit with a large bass drum that would have been originally designed for marching bands. And that's maybe a distinction to be made between a modern day drum kit where those bass drums have now shrunken in size considerably. Back in the day, they would have literally taken, you know, a big 26-inch marching band drum and placed it on the floor. But he would have also been playing, well, snare drum, of course, and then a couple of cymbals, one probably of Turkish origin, and then another Chinese cymbal. The Chinese cymbals were extremely popular in jazz music, and they have a different shape, a sort of inverted flange on the outer end of them, and they give a kind of slightly noisier, trashier sound, but it, you know, very widespread on these early drum kits. And he would have also probably been using what was called a Chinese tam-tam, which was a traditional drum, usually with like beautiful decorative painting on it that was affixed to the side of the bass drum. And this would have been used in Chinese opera originally, but also something that the jazz drummers borrowed as a kind of special effect. And that eventually evolved into the modern tom-toms that we see on drum kits today. And then he probably would have had also, you know, just a couple of other percussive accessories to add some color, you know, around the rim of that bass drum that he would play, and also maybe wood blocks as well.
You're describing how the drum kit has this international conglomeration of looking around for different type of items, Turkish cymbals, the tam-tam, which becomes the tom-tom when it becomes tunable. It's really, when you look at the drum kit, you can see a global item.
Absolutely.
Contraction.
Yeah, you would take these, you know, this bass drum and snare drum from a European marching band context, Chinese cymbal and tam-tam from a traditional Chinese music context. You would take African-American performance practices that would be playing these instruments in ways in which they would never have been used in their original context.
But many of these items had to be invented. And it seems like one of the key inventions was the Ludwig bass pedal.
William F. Ludwig was a drummer himself. He played in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And he was not just a great drummer, but also an excellent designer and inventor. And he was faced with a problem in the early 1900s when ragtime was becoming a popular style. And he was... Although he used a bass drum pedal that had been designed by someone else in the city, Chicago being a very key place for drum manufacturing in the United States as a whole, he found that those earlier bass drum pedal designs didn't allow him to play that bass drum at the quick tempos that were demanded for ragtime. He was able to translate his design to die-cast metal and mass-produce this. And it's still very similar to the bass drum pedal design that we would use in the 21st century.
Often drummers would look around for what's available to them to come up with the sounds that they needed. And it's interesting how fly swatters were incorporated into playing on the snare drum. And people still call wire brushes fly swatters.
Interestingly, I guess in the 1910s, there were... sort of eerily reminiscent of the situation today, there were often worries about airborne diseases, and thought by some that that flies and mosquitoes could carry diseases that would infect humans. So people were coming up with lots of interesting designs for fly swatters, and as it turned out, these worked extremely well on snare drums when you were trying to approximate what was sometimes called sand dancing, where people would pour sand across dance floors and dancers would scrape their heels along and create also patterns in the dance floor. This was a popular dance at the time. And this was accompanied very well by these wire brushes, which were also much quieter than sticks as well. So to have a kind of alternative beater that you could use to strike drums that was not quite as loud as a drumstick was also very helpful in an age, as you say, before amplification, where drummers might be expected to support, you know, a very small band and play very quietly. So yeah, it's a direct offshoot of these fly swatters, which were widespread in the 1910s, that then became very popular for drummers.
Here is Papa Joe Jones on the brushes performing Old Man River.
Things change really significantly with the big band era, and maybe the first big shift here is increasing attention onto the drummer as a star performer. So you don't really see many drummers who are actually band leaders until Chick Webb in Harlem, who starts leading his own band in the second half of the 1920s. Is an incredibly influential drummer. He plays at all kinds of dance ballrooms, throughout Upper Manhattan in the 1920s and throughout the 1930s. And lots of other aspiring drummers go to watch him and to learn from him, including Buddy Rich, including Gene Krupa. So really, many drummers who in the long view of history become more famous than Chick Webb himself really cite him as the kind of key inspiration in terms of thinking of the drummer as a star performer, as a celebrity, as a band leader, as the lead artist in their own right. And Krupa is one of these people. So Krupa, who was born in Chicago, he ends up moving to New York, relocating there at the end of the 1920s, and learning by watching Chick Webb play and many other drummers in Manhattan, trying to figure out what it is with their technique, with their showmanship, that allows this thing that would become big band swing to be a significant stylistic change. In the first half of the 1930s, Krupa meets up with Benny Goodman, both of whom have been playing in Broadway orchestra pits, and Goodman is convinced to hire on Krupa for a new band that he's assembling for radio broadcasts. And so the Benny Goodman Band, they're often credited with taking a particular form of dance band music that was innovated and developed by African-American dance bands who didn't necessarily have the platform to popularize that type of music, and then taking that to radio and reaching a mass audience with that. Gene Krupa is quickly identified as the key featured musician within the Benny Goodman Band. He's the most popular member of the band. He is flamboyant, virtuosic, very showy, very flashy with his technique, and he's an instant hit. And it becomes very clear that drummers hold a very special place within big bands. And you can listen to Benny Goodman's famous Carnegie Hall concert of 1938 and really hear the audience reacting to Krupa in particular. And that actually ends up causing a rift between Goodman and Krupa, and they end up going their separate ways shortly after that concert. That's a kind of pivotal moment, I think, for not just drumming in terms of musical style, but also in terms of the status of the drummer as a performer. The other thing to say about the swing era is that that's when the drum kit as an instrument really takes on its modern shape. So prior to the swing era, as we were talking about, you would have drum kits that would have this kind of hodgepodge of percussion accessories sort of strewn all about the bass drum, sometimes put on a small table or consolette on top of the bass drum. So lots of special effects, kind of legacy of the silent film era, or of this vaudevillian drummer playing different sound effects. But in the mid-1930s, that becomes very much streamlined. And that's the result of a design collaboration between Gene Krupa and a Chicago manufacturer called Slingerland. And he ends up stripping away all of those percussive accessories, modifying the tom-toms so that they become tunable in their own right, and really kind of creating a design that looks pretty much similar and unchanged to a drum kit that you would go into a music store and buy today.
From big bands, that continues to be a major presence in American pop culture, but there's also bebop developing as well. And we see a lot of innovation about how to use the expression of the drums in bebop.
One of the key innovations, I guess, in the development of bebop comes with the drum kit. And there's a particular drummer named Kenny Clarke, who's quite important in this. At the beginning of the 1940s, Kenny Clarke and then shortly afterwards Max Roach are really pivotal in moving the time feel of the drum kit over to the ride cymbal and the hi-hat. And so keeping time with those two cymbals and then providing accents or counterpoints on bass drum, snare drum, and tom-toms, and really spreading out the drum kit in a more melodic way where they're able to kind of maybe think of each percussion instrument as a different note on a scale. And that really fundamentally changes the function of the drum kit in those bands because it removes that steady pulse. It removes that four on the floor of the bass drum, that steady dance beat, and jazz music moves in a totally different direction. At the same time, you do have dance bands that that continue to play, so groups like Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five, who are maintaining that kind of steady pulse, but they become considered not so much jazz, but the forefathers of a different sort of music, rhythm and blues, where that dance beat is maintained.
Let's go to break hearing Max Roach playing George's Dilemma. More drums when the source comes back. Thank you. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're talking about the history and the evolution of the drum kit. And I want to visit with this longtime drummer, known as Sticky Wicket, or just Sticks. He leads a swing band in England and performs on vintage drums, and he has a deep appreciation for the drum kit.
Well, it is. It is a musical instrument in its own right. I mean, it was, of course, there were separate instruments way back, with cymbals and drums, snare drums and bass drums, particularly in orchestral and marching bands. But ironically, I'm an Englishman, but the drum kit as an entity and an instrument is really an American invention back in the late teens and early 20s.
How did you become a drummer? What's your drum story?
Well, very, very young. I was about five or six years old. And my dad used to buy lots of records, especially rock and roll records and jazz records, some classical too. But I was really inspired by the rhythms of jazz and rock and roll and stuff back in the 50s. And my mum actually had a couple of drums that were from the 1920s, which was child drums, but they had proper drum heads on them. In fact, I have a complete set now, very similar to what my mum had a couple of orphan stray drums from. And she gave them to me. I was really kind of serious. My parents used to think, you know, this isn't a toy for Alan was my real name for Alan. But so as it progressed, I used to play along to my dad's records. And he gave me a guitar one time, thinking it might be more interesting for him to play what he considered to be a more musical instrument. But so there's a picture of me when I'm 6 years old playing this tin guitar, but I never bothered to tune it. Rhythm was my most interesting thing. And then eventually my cousin bought a drum kit and I borrowed that for a while when he wasn't using it. And so, you know, the origins of my fascination and dedication to drums began there, but that was about when I was about sort of 10 or 11 years old.
You've seen a lot of the great drummers in history of music, rock and roll, and big bands. What are your favorites?
Oh, well, I suppose it's very difficult because there are so many great drummers, but I suppose, you know, Gene Krupa, all American guys, and Joe Jones, whom I met. Papa Joe Jones, yes, and that was in a store. I was on tour with the band in 1976. It was known as in New York City, called Frank Ippoluto's Drum Store, and I walked into there and I was looking, choosing some cymbals, and I was aware of guys saying to me, "Yeah, the one in your middle is the one you want." So I got talking to him, and it was Joe Jones, Papa Joe, which was quite a revelation for me as a young drummer, first time in America. And, of course, other drummers, I mean, no drummer can ignore Buddy Rich because he was a master of the instrument. Whatever your opinions of music, he was just superb in terms of his control, his delivery, and his musicality.
Seeing videos of you playing the drums, you're also a showman drummer. You put on a show when you bang on the skins. You saw Keith Moon. Was he also somebody that you would say... left an impression?
Drumming is such a fun thing to do, and so to share that fun with an audience by doing some showmanship things, even if they're just silly things, you know, like playing around the theater, hitting floors and walls and stuff, you know, it's people find that fun, and it's all part of rhythm that is entertainment. But I did see Keith Moon, and I thought the band were great, very, very loud. I was a bit of a fan of the Who's in the early days, of course. Everybody was. I was more into rock, really, as a kid than in jazz, although, you know, my dad had influenced me on the jazz side. But I was lucky enough growing up in Birmingham to be friends with Bill Ward from Black Sabbath before they were famous. And I used to love watching his playing because he was a really powerful player. but had something, a unique quality amongst other drummers that were my favorites that I didn't really realize, but it was the fact that they actually had a swing in their play. I didn't analyze it at the time, but you know, there were drummers like Ian Paice from Deep Purple, John Bonham, of course, and of course Bill Ward from Black Sabbath. They were three of my favorites at the time that I followed quite a lot, and yeah, I sort of influenced a little bit by them in some way, but it was the swing in their play and the musicality that I loved.
Do you think it's the drummer that makes the drum, or the other way around? How important is it to have all of the whistles and bells, so to speak, or a drummer can make turn anything into a drum?
Well, that's a very good question, which is difficult to analyze. I mean, I think the latter is definitely true. You know, I've been on occasions where drummers have sat in with bands, you know, sort of jam sessions or whatever you call it, open mics these days, and different drummers can make the same drum set and the same setup in the same venue sound so different. And it's a question of application of playing it and the feel that the particular drummer has. And so I'd say, yeah, give a good drummer a good drum set, and that's a great result.
So obviously we can hear the exuberance that you have and the joy and the zest that you have for drumming and life. Do you think that had you not been able to pursue drumming throughout your entire life and embrace it, that you probably wouldn't have been able to be so zestful?
Well, yeah, probably right. I mean, I was so determined as a kid that my parents could see that, that, you know, there was nothing going to stop me, so they helped me. So I don't know what I've done if I wasn't a drummer. Can't think.
Sticky Wicket has a YouTube channel called Next Level Chops, and he gigs around England leading the Sticky Wicket Swing Orchestra. When we come back from this break, we'll see how the drum kit adapted to the rock and roll era. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're back with Matt Brennan, author of Kick It, A Social History of the Drum Kit. We move into the rock and roll era with the Beatles.
I got something to say that might cause you pain. If I catch you talking to that boy again, I'm gonna let you down.
What is it about Ringo Starr playing his drum kit with the Beatles, this left-handed drummer playing a right-handed kit with the Beatles?
Well, I guess the first thing to say about Ringo Starr is that you know, he's part of a broader musical movement. You know, in the early 1960s, the music that we would now consider to be kind of early rock and roll or British invasion music in the UK was, these were referred to as beat groups, where this emphasis on, you know, steady, strong, loud dance pulse was absolutely core. And Ringo was, the kind of best example of this in Liverpool, where this scene was happening. So the last member of the Beatles to join the group, replacing Pete Best before they reached their final form. Ringo was, you would say, maybe the foundation on which the rest of the group were able to compose their work. He has an incredible time field. He's one of these drummers where you only need to listen to the music for a few seconds before realizing, ah, that's Ringo, or indeed someone trying to imitate Ringo.
I think I'm gonna be sad. I think it's today. Yeah. The girl that's driving me mad is going away. She's got a ticket to ride.
And And I guess another key thing about Ringo is that his parts are often very composerly. Oftentimes, his drum parts are really integral part of the song. So not just playing a backbeat, but playing fills, which, you know, are just as important as any guitar riff that the other members of the band would have played. You know, very distinctive signature elements of a song that without them it just wouldn't be that song.
Ringo also played with match grip. What does that mean?
Match grip basically just means that you're holding both drumsticks the same way. So, you know, having the stick lay between your thumb and your index finger, and then kind of curling the rest of your fingers around that drumstick in order to keep its bounce. And that would be in contrast against traditional group, where you would have the left hand holding the drumstick with the fulcrum between the thumb and the index finger, but then cradling the drumstick between two pairs of fingers in the rest of the hand, coming as a legacy out of military drumming. A clue, if you're looking to see whether a drummer is either jazz trained or perhaps learned to play drums in a military context, is whether they are holding the drumsticks differently in each hand, i.e. with traditional grip.
Put us to death. Talking about my generation. Just because we get around. Talking about my generation. Things ain't do look awful. Talking about my generation. I hope I die before I get old. Talking about my generation.
Keith Moon brought a level of showmanship that we had previously only seen in jazz. What's really interesting about that first generation of rock drummers that we now think of as canonical, so, you know, your Ringos and Charlie Watts and Keith Moons and John Bonhams, is that, you know, their heroes were often jazz drummers. So Keith Moon was a huge fan of Gene Krupa. He was a huge fan of the spectacle that he would see in big band drummers. So he famously went with Ginger Baker to see a Duke Ellington concert in the mid-1960s, where the drummer Sam Woodyard was playing a double bass drum kit. And Keith Moon said, I'm definitely having that. So he quickly assembled his own double bass drum kit. So that sense of creating the drummer as a larger-than-life figure with a larger-than-life instrument can be credited to Moon. Obviously, because of his personality, he also embodied a lot of the wildness and nonconformity that drummers are maybe stereotypically thought to have. He sort of characterized that very well. John Bonham is maybe considered the most influential hard rock drummer of all time. He was a product of his time. You can sort of think about one element of Bonham is that people might immediately recognize is not just setting new benchmarks for drumming technique, but also the sheer volume that he brought out of those drums. You know, he was a very loud drummer and was very much determined not to be drowned out by guitarists, which he said in interviews multiple times. But that sort of requires guitarists to be quite loud in the first place. And you know, there's a reason why rock sort of increases in volume. It's because it becomes technologically possible to do so in the second half of the 1960s. So Marshall amplifiers, for instance, are really you know, a 1960s development. The wattage that you're able to get from a guitar amplifier just increases over that decade. Jim Marshall, actually, the inventor of Marshall amps, was a big band drummer himself. But once you have guitarists playing amps of that size and power, drummers need to respond in turn. And Bonham was the kind of epitome of this. So, you know, not to be outdone by Jimmy Page or John Paul Jones, he was able to hold his own, an extremely powerful drummer, but also a virtuosic drummer. And you can really hear that on a track like Good Time, Bad Times, where you hear these really fast-footed triplet figures on the bass drum that that Bonham's able to play on this opening track of Led Zeppelin's debut album.
Also, in Led Zeppelin, John Bonham is sometimes playing one rhythm and the guitarists are playing another rhythm simultaneously, yeah. Like an Immigrant Song.
Absolutely. So, you know, not afraid of polyrhythms, you know, a really intelligent drummer. And I think that, you know, a lot of drummers maybe get stereotyped as sort of being, you know, perhaps somewhat inferior in terms of artistic status to some of their bandmates. But when you think about John Bonham's, you know, contributions to these songs, he's, you know, his choices, his technique are this perfect blend that suit the song at the one hand, on the one hand, but also push the drum kit as an instrument in terms of performance into new directions. He was charting new territory.
And we still see innovation coming to the drum kit, like with Questlove and Roots and his approach to drumming, bringing together different music styles.
Absolutely. One of the most interesting turns, I think, in terms of the history of the drum kit is the importance of drum sounds in hip hop music and sampling the drum kit and putting it into, you know, new contexts through digital sampling. So taking drum breaks and then transforming them through record production to create sounds that an acoustic drum kit player might have never been able to play, and then having someone like Questlove, who then takes that acoustic drum kit and tries to emulate that highly produced, digitally sampled sound of a drum kit on an acoustic drum kit, you know, sort of creating this feedback loop and pushing the boundaries for the sort of studio iterations and the live performance iterations of the instrument. But with technologies like the MPC sampler, artists, particularly in hip-hop production, are suddenly able to, you know, sample those drum kits and allow them to be performed and played in ways which humans might, you know, never have been able to imagine to do, let alone technically be able to do prior to that point. And that's a really interesting development as we sort of see this this dialogue happening between you know, the acoustic drum kit, the history of its performance practice, and then its adaptation and remixing in the studio with new digital technologies.
Gifted at finding what I don't like the most. So I think it's time for us to have a toast. Let's have a toast for the douchebags. Let's have a toast for the Let's have a toast for the scumbags. Every one of them that I know. Let's have a toast for the jerk-offs that'll never take work off. Baby, I got a plan. Run away fast as you can. Find pictures in my email.
You write about how there is a general looking down on drummers in society. For example, like in The Muppets, the drummer is this character Animal, who is portrayed as somebody who is primal, feral, not fit for polite environments. Do we need to rectify that?
Yeah, I think that you can absolutely find the origins of that, unfortunately, in racist stereotypes about drumming that really take hold in the 19th century, where drumming is seen as a form of musical practice that is outside of the European symphonic tradition, that is associated with non-Western cultures, that is associated often with cultures and regions where Europe had colonial power. And so there's this whole justification that gets made in the 19th century on musical grounds and all kinds of other grounds that's basically trying in some way to naturalize the dehumanization of other people and other cultures. And drumming gets kind of quite unfortunately wrapped up in that. These are stereotypes, and yet the vestiges of them are still in place. And I think that that's something that, you know, history really helps to illuminate and hopefully allows us to think in more nuanced and socially just ways about where that instrument stands in musical cultures today.
Matt Brennan is the author of Kick It, A Social History of the Drum Kit. Let's close out with Smashing Pumpkins' I Am One. The drummer is Jimmy Chamberlain. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Ken Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.